One of the greatest union victories in decades took place in Los Angeles County in 1999, where, after an 11-year campaign, the Service Employees International Union won the right to represent 74,000 home health care workers. That same year, the newly merged unions of garment workers and textile workers, called UNITE, Union of Needle Trades, Industrial, and Textile Employees, which had been trying for 25 years to organize cannon mills in North Carolina, won their union election at two mills in Kannapolis. Women were taking a leading role in the new leadership of the AFL-CIO. Karen Nussbaum, who had been president of the 9-to-5 National Association of Working Women, became director of the Working Women's Department of the AFL-CIO. And by 1998, 10 of the 21 departments of the union were headed by women. An alliance between students and the labor movement was being forged by the campaign for a living wage for campus workers, which soon spread to 150 college campuses. For instance, at Harvard University, students organized to demand that the Harvard administration, sitting on a treasury of $20 billion, should pay their janitors and other service employees a wage sufficient to support their families. Many of these workers had to work two jobs, as much as 80 hours a week, to pay for rent and food and medical care. The Harvard students staged colorful rallies in which janitors and other campus workers spoke about their needs. Members of the Cambridge City Council and trade union leaders, including John Sweeney and other high officers of the AFL-CIO, took the microphone to declare their support. The arrival of two young movie stars, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, to support the campaign attracted a huge crowd. Both had lived and gone to school in Cambridge. Matt Damon had spent a few years at Harvard before dropping out to go to Hollywood. Ben Affleck spoke movingly about his father working, poorly paid, at a menial job at Harvard. When the Harvard administration continued to refuse to negotiate, 40 students took over one of the Harvard administrative buildings and remained there day and night for several weeks, supported by hundreds of people outside, with tents spread out on the campus grass. Support for the sit-in came from all over the country, and finally, Harvard agreed to negotiate. The upshot was a victory for the campus workers, with Harvard agreeing to raise the pay of janitors to $14 an hour and to give health benefits, and to insist that outside contractors match those conditions. In the spring of 2000, students at Wesleyan University in Connecticut occupy the admissions office, insisting that the university president guarantee a living wage, health and retirement benefits, and job security to janitors and other service workers. After several days of the sit-in, the university agreed to comply with the demands. Students around the country organized a workers' rights consortium. At Yale University, the University of Arizona, Syracuse University, the University of Kentucky, and on many other campuses, students carried on campaigns to support the demands of working people. The living wage campaign took a powerful hold on popular sympathies at a time when the rich were becoming richer. In Duluth, Minnesota, 56 organizations joined forces to demand that the city give contracts only to businesses that gave a living wage. This meant several dollars above the official minimum wage to employees. The 5-year limit on federal aid to families with dependent children, set in the 1996 welfare reform legislation, meant that millions of people would face deprivation when their benefits expired. Activists began organizing seriously in the year 2000 for that eventuality, bringing people from all over the country into a campaign to end poverty. A veteran of the welfare rights movement in Boston, Diane Dujon, declared, "In the richest country in the year 2000, no one should be living hungry, homeless, and under stress of not knowing how to feed their children and still pay their rent." The Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign in 1998 organized a bus tour of 35 cities to pull together the stories of people who could not feed their families, whose electricity had been cut off, who had been evicted from their homes because they could not afford to pay their bills. The following year, some members of that organization traveled to Geneva, Switzerland, to testify before the UN Commission on Human Rights. They pointed to the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt had helped to draw up, and which declared that decent wages, food, housing, health care, and education were rights of all people. Religious leaders, who had been quiet since their involvement in the movements for civil rights and against the Vietnam War, began to speak out on economic inequality. In the summer of 1996, the New York Times reported, "More than at any other time in decades, religious leaders are making common cause with trade unions, lending their moral authority to denounce sweatshops, back a higher minimum wage, and help organize janitors and poultry workers. The clergy has not lined up with labor to such an extent since the heyday of Cesar Chavez, the charismatic farm workers' leader in the 1970s, and perhaps the Depression." All of these groups and the people they represented, the homeless, the struggling mothers, the families unable to pay their bills, the 40 million without health insurance, and the many more with inadequate insurance, were facing an enormous barrier of silence in the national culture. Their lives, their plight, was not being reported in the major media. And so the myth of a prosperous America, proclaimed by powerful people in Washington and Wall Street, persisted. There were valiant attempts to break through the control of information, especially after the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which enabled the handful of corporations dominating the airwaves to expand their power further. Mergers enabled tighter control of information. Two gigantic media corporations, CBS and Viacom, joined in a $37 billion deal. The Latin American writer Eduardo Galeano commented, "Never have so many been held incommunicado by so few." Alternative media made desperate attempts to break through this control. There were several hundred community radio stations around the country. The Pacifica Network was the most successful of these, bringing alternative information and ideas to their listeners. A one-man operation by David Bassamian, Alternative Radio, distributed dissident views, interviews, and lectures via satellite to radio stations around the country. Community newspapers in towns and cities around the country, though their circulation was small, tried to tell the stories of ordinary people. In Boston, homeless people joined to publish the newspaper Spare Change, to tell their stories, print their poems, and then to sell the newspaper on the streets of Boston and Cambridge as a way of making some money. They declared their aims to be a voice for the voiceless and an organizing tool for the homeless community. By the turn of the century, they had been turning out the newspaper for 8 years. This idea spread to other parts of the country, and soon there were street newspapers in 40 different cities, which formed the North American Street Newspaper Association. The National Coalition for the Homeless, set up in the nation's capital, distributed a monthly newsletter. Probably the most dramatic attempt to bring to the American people and to the world the facts of corporate domination over the lives of ordinary people was the great gathering of demonstrators in Seattle, Washington, in the last months of 1999. Seattle had been chosen as the meeting place of the World Trade Organization, and representatives of the most powerful and wealthy institutions on the globe were there to make plans to maintain their wealth and power, to bring the principles of capitalism to work across national boundaries, over all the earth. Tens of thousands of people converged on Seattle to protest the plans of the World Trade Organization to expand free trade agreements. This, the protesters argued, meant that the freedom of corporations to roam the globe in search of cheap labor and no restrictions on industrial policies that poison the environment would be enhanced. The issues around free trade were complex, but a simple idea seemed to unite those who showed up in Seattle to oppose the WTO, that the health and freedom of ordinary people all over the world should not be sacrificed on behalf of corporate profit. More than 1,000 organizations from 90 countries representing labor unions, environmental groups, consumers, religious groups, farmers, indigenous people, women's groups, and more had signed a statement asking governments to stop the expansion of the World Trade Organization. In Seattle, there was a remarkable set of alliances. Steelworkers rallied with environmentalists, and machinists joined animal rights activists. Farmers joined a huge labor march of 40,000 on November 30th, and then union people attended a family farm rally a few days later. The press gave disproportionate attention to a small number of demonstrators who broke windows and created a ruckus. But the overwhelming majority in Seattle were nonviolent, and it was these that the police chose to attack with tear gas and then arrest. Hundreds were jailed, but the demonstrations continued. News of the events in Seattle went to the nation and all over the world. The official WTO meeting was clearly disturbed by the crowds of protesters, and there were signs of division between the industrial countries and third world countries. As John Nichols reported in the Progressive magazine, while the official WTO sessions were characterized by deep divides between delegations from the northern and southern hemispheres, there was an unprecedented level of north-south unity on the streets. Farmers from around the world came together. The huge AFL-CIO rally cheered speakers from close to a dozen countries. And after events organized to highlight the devastating impact that globalization was having on women in the third world, throngs of women from Africa, Latin America, India, Europe, and the United States marched together in human chains through the streets of downtown Seattle. The summit meeting of the World Trade Organization was shaken by all this, and at a certain point, the talks collapsed. It was a remarkable illustration of the ability of organized citizens to challenge the most powerful corporations in the world. Mike Brannan, writing in the newspaper of the insurgent Teamsters, caught the mood of exultation. The kind of solidarity that all of us dream of was in the air, as people sang, chanted, played music, and stood up to the cops and the WTO. The people owned the streets that day, and it was as much a lesson for us as it was for corporate America. The Seattle demonstrations coincided with a growing movement throughout the nation, on college campuses and in communities, against sweatshop conditions endured by third world men, women, even children working for American corporations. The New York Times reported, a month after Seattle, pressure from college students and other opponents of sweatshops has led some factories that make goods for industry giants like Nike and The Gap to cut back on child labor, to use less dangerous chemicals, and to require fewer employees to work 80-hour weeks, according to groups that monitor such factories. The New York Times continued, at last month's protests in Seattle, conditions in such factories were a major focus, with many demonstrators demanding that trade treaties punish countries that permit violations of minimum labor standards. Many corporate executives acknowledge that the anti-sweatshop movement's efforts are paying off. Seattle was the first of a series of international gatherings of trade union people, students, environmentalists, in opposition to the increasing control of the world economy by giant corporations. In the year following the Seattle demonstrations, protesters showed up wherever a summit of wealthy entrepreneurs was taking place: Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Davos, Switzerland, Los Angeles, and Prague. Officials of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund could not ignore such a protest movement. They began to declare their concern for the environment and the conditions of their workers. Whether this would result in real changes was unclear, but undoubtedly, the corporate leaders of the world could no longer ignore their critics. Would the various strands of protest and resistance, in politics, in the workplace, in the culture, come together in the next century, the next millennium, to fulfill the promise of the Declaration of Independence, of equal rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? No one could predict. All one could do was to act on the possibility, knowing that inaction would make any prediction a gloomy one. If democracy were to be given any meaning, if it were to go beyond the limits of capitalism and nationalism, this would not come, if history were any guide, from the top. It would come through citizens' movements, educating, organizing, agitating, striking, boycotting, demonstrating, threatening those in power with disruption of the stability they needed.